bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting. Hello, welcome to The Photo Show. I'm Ewan Rankin, professional photographer here in the UK, and I'm joined by my usual colleagues. Top left, we've got Mr. Chris Forsman here to discuss the week's photography news. How you doing, mate?
Not too shabby.
Show me haircut, dude. Show him the sides. Zzz. There you go. No sides. Good one, mate. Good week?
It's been busy. I mean, I don't know if you heard about this mountain lion crap.
No, well, did one get caught somewhere and they've had the down a well?
Yeah, one got caught in the Mac App Store.
I have been using it, and apparently it's very good for photographers. We'll talk about that later, but I can't see why Finder's any good for anybody, to be honest. It's not even good for finding files, so we shall see. not by any means last but least, because there's only three of us. Mr. Fox, how are you doing, sir?
Oh, very well. Just about that Finder, I went to use it because I saw an article. I couldn't remember where the bloody hell you found Finder. So I couldn't find Finder. There you go, you see.
Finder's not... I've got to say, I think Finder's a piece of crap and always has been and always will be, but we'll never go. There we go. The week's photography news. It's pretty good, actually. We've not done too badly at all this week. Some interesting stuff as well. It's not usually the kind of mundane releases. There's a new piece of software out there, which I think is kind of interesting. This would be a good conversation, maybe, called TinEye. T-I-N-E-Y-E, all one word. It's a free reverse image search engine. And what it does is you stick the URL of an image or the image itself into TinEye, and TinEye goes out around the internet and sees if it can find a copy of it. And apparently it does quite well. This is a picture of Taylor Swift and what's the name of the dude? Kanye West at the MTV Awards. And someone published a bit of this image with just Taylor Swift on it, holding the award, and TinEye found it. Now, has anyone had a play with this?
I've actually been using the beta for maybe a couple years.
Has it been in beta for 2 years?
I honestly can't remember how long I've been using it, but I've been using it a lot.
Okay. And?
So, I've used it to find where people were using my pictures without permission. I've used it to find the original source for it. Like sometimes I find like an image I want to use for a story and it's clearly not the original source. And, so then I use it to just find where else the picture might be posted. And usually you can track down the original source.
And have you actually found any?
Found any what?
That have been duplicated. That have been copied and stolen, plenty.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent. Are they all on our website from Ars Technica? Because we crib a lot of your images for news stories and stuff and banners.
No. Usually we're looking for illegitimate use.
Right. So, okay. Yeah. Alex, had a play?
No, it sort of worries me a bit, only as in... Quite often I see people put things on something like Facebook and they... sort of put a copyright or please don't copy this, and you think, well, no, you're just playing at being a photographer, you know. If you're going to stick something out in certain environments, you've got to say
it's going to go. Oh, look,
it's going to go, right? And what worries me is you're going to get lots of people out there that are amateur at the best that want to play big boy photography, if you like, and they're going to say, "All right, you've got me. I'm going to sue them. I want £1 million." And basically, it's going to waste an awful lot of people's time. A lot of people, you know, you might have the odd solicitor or lawyer that decides to just take a fee just for saying, "No, we can't do anything about it." But I think, in theory, it's a good idea to know on a professional basis. But what makes me worry is, being this is a free piece of software, you're going to get so many people that basically get the wrong end of the stick. The law, maybe they're even legally correct that person shouldn't have taken it. But unless you're a multimillionaire with absolutely nothing else to do in your life other than pay lawyers, there's probably nothing you can do. And it might just lead to a lot of frustration and a lot of people really not knowing what the real outcome could be.
Yeah, I mean, I had a little play with it today, and I put in some images that I knew were on other websites that it should have trolled, and it didn't pick any of them up. So one of the problems I've got is I don't doubt it has a capability to do it. It just couldn't do it with any of my images. And also, the thing that bothers me is how it returns the results, because I know there's a little counter that says the number of times it's found that it's a duplication. Chris, if it returns a compatible match that it has found, how does it give you that information? Does it tell you where it is and give you an image of what the web page looks like? Or does it just give you a URL? Because I'd have thought there was a safety and security link there with URL. And also possibly, you know, you may get a website, torrent website, child pornography website, that kind of thing, where you go and click on the link to go and see what they've done with your image, and you end up in a world of hurt as a result.
Well, you can see the URL before you click it.
Okay. But unfortunately, though, most things like child porn sites aren't called childporn.com.
Right. I mean, there's always that danger, but I suppose maybe I've never run into that because of the pictures I'm searching for. I mean, I'm usually looking for, like, images of, you know, Sandy Bridge die shots, or, you know, like some image of some old, you know, like a Newton or something to illustrate something. So I guess I've never run into that.
Iconographers and stuff like that. If someone makes a cool icon and someone rips the icon, that could go on a very broad range of websites, but it would still be picked up as an image, and it would still be picked up as your image.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I reckon without, I mean, it's not a brag, I suppose, I reckon 95% of my images are stolen. And I just accept that because of the vast majority of people that steal my images are students or art lovers that just want to look at or have a copy, a small copy normally, but have a copy of a piece of work. And you know what? It makes the world go round. They're not going to pay me any money. It's not hurting me in any way. And as far as I'm concerned, yes, I own the rights to that image, but as far as I'm concerned, live and let live.
Well, yes, but I can't. I mean, that's a different discussion from whether tin eye is a good thing or a bad thing, perhaps.
Yeah, but the thing is, other people might just say, "Oh, right, okay, I could say 50,000 of my last 55,000 image have been stolen." And I could go crazy about that, knowing that figure. I could go crazy. You know, if you're of that type of mind that doesn't quite understand the reality of the law, right? And, you know, the letter of the law says no one should steal your photography.
Yeah.
But the reality of the law is, do yourself a favour, and in certain circumstances, you're probably just better off not knowing.
So, I mean, Chris, is there a policy at ours around this, or have you got kind of an unwritten policy for yourself where, I take one of your images, if one of your articles, because without a link back, because it's a nice banner for one of the shows that I've done this week, and I'll probably do it for today's. and you find that through
without a link back? That's not very nice.
No, exactly. So, supposing I do that, would you then...
Can't just put a little link? Come on.
Would you then contact... We give you exposure, dude. Come on. Would you then put a link... Would you?
Oh, yeah.
You need it. You know you need it. Would you? Shut up and let me finish my statement. Would you then have a policy that said, well, look, you've only used it to illustrate something and be done with it, and you're not making any money off that? Or would are you looking clearly for commercial gain from people with it?
I shouldn't be quoting any official policy, really, but we don't spend a lot of time, it's not like we go through every image and be like, okay, who's ripping us off?
Yeah.
That's just a waste of our time.
Yeah.
Because we're busy, you know, creating content. If we do find it and there's no link back and it's not used for any kind of illustrative purposes or journalistic purposes or whatever, I know in the past that we have sent takedown notices when our content's been copied inappropriately. Mm. If someone is using, and I think that we're pretty upfront about it, but if someone's like posting a summary or a link to our article and they want to also have the picture, that's usually not an issue at all. But I think it's definitely not law, but it's definitely considered a courtesy that when you use someone else's content like that,
Yeah, I should put a link up.
You put a link back. I mean, that's just...
No, that's right. The only thing that bothered me last thing was that when you do an image result, it says, we've searched over 2.17 billion images. Mm-hmm. And it's got a hyperlink on that 2.17 billion images. And I just thought, I hovered my mouse over it. I know I'm being stupid here, but I was thinking, that's going to take me ages to close all those tabs.
Yeah, there's that shortcut, though, isn't there, which closes all open windows, so you'll be all right.
Oh, right. I need to learn that then, obviously.
Only because I've done it before with like an entire folder of, say, 500 images, and they've all opened. But I always have to go onto another computer, go on Safari and look what the shortcut is, because I can never remember it. Close all open windows.
XCAP is a marvellous looking little kind of invention, I think. It's an auto-closing lens cap for mirrorless cameras. So if you've got one of the little new mirrorless cameras and you're having trouble with protection of your lens, this thing goes on, and I don't know how it works, but it puts a little fake lens over the front.
Yeah, I looked at it before. I could vaguely tell you how it works.
Well, go on then, sir. Explain to us how this marvellous little thing works.
I've lost sound again.
There you haven't. I got you. Now you've gone.
Okay. Can everyone hear me?
I can hear you. How did you just find all through all of that? No, he's disappeared. There you go. So you're never going to find out how XCAP works. Because Alex Fox has gone. Are you there, Alex? No, he's not there. He's gone. I'll just hang up and then that'll be easier. Chris, do you know it works?
You know, I'm not 100% sure. I had to fix these retracting caps on point and shoots a lot when I worked at the camera shop years ago. So, I mean, basically, you just have two shutters. It was on,
you have
on springs.
An incoming call from Alex Fox.
That roll out the way.
Yeah, you have these two caps that go like this, or they, you know, move up and down, whatever, into the cap. And what it appears to me is that there's some kind of, on the back side of it, something that when the lens retracts into the body, there's... Yeah. You know, there's part of the...
It just depresses something, yeah.
Yeah, it pushes on that and activates the...
Well, now you've finished your guest explanation. Mr. Fox is going to give us the definitive, I hope.
I had a look at this before, previously. Yeah, it's more or less... It's just a loaded spring. And when it goes right to the back, there's a tiny little push. It's not a button as such, but it's a tiny little push on it. Once that is... depressed, it allows the spring to close. So as long as that button is pressed, the shutter is shut, and as soon as it's depressed again, the shutter opens.
Right, there we go.
Mm-hmm.
No word on price.
So just like I said.
Words on availability. But if you're struggling with your little your mirrorless, then help will be at hand at some point. I don't know if it's a Kickstarter-y type thing. That would be cool, wouldn't it? But
yeah.
Mountain Lion's release, unless you've been on Mars, you should have seen it. Twitter was a blast. It was nothing but Mountain Lion, I thought, the other day. And apparently, according to an article on iPhoneincanada.ca, which is a... no, that's the wrong one. I've looked at the wrong article. I'm good, aren't I? Where's the article? I can't...
Colton Mac?
This is Colton Mac, thank you. According to Colton Mac, new Mountain Lion Finder is fantastic for photographers. Now, I'm not a lover of Finder, as anyone who listens to this network will know. Do you guys agree, disagree, discuss?
Well, I think what they're talking about is the fact that basically you can make the icon. So in the Finder, you can have image files have an image preview of the icon.
Which you always could.
Right. But in Mountain Lion, you can make them really huge. And with some of the graphics... improvements in Mountain Lion, it's actually you can scroll them really fast. So you know, and I've actually used Finder this way for a long time, just to do my first edit pass.
Yeah, now
I just load everything up, scroll through it. I mean, anything that's obviously blurry or a bad shot or not anything that I'm interested in, I just delete.
Now, resizing before though was always you could only do it in the icon view. You couldn't resize it unless you resize the window in quick view.
Right.
Now this is kind of like the scrolly past view allows you to improve the size, which it never did before. That's the big change.
Yeah, there's a little control on the status bar that lets you just zoom the icons up to 512 pixels. So
brilliant. How to play, Alex? Impressed?
Yeah, I did. Well, the thing is, it's slightly. What they're so one of the things they're talking about is there's extra fields in the search menus for Finder now. And one of the things you can do is you can look for specific things. But it's not just photographic specific things. You can look for bit rates on files. You can look, you know, so it, there's loads of separated search criteria which are predefined. And some of them are picture relative, some are music, some are video. So there's a whole list. So you can say it's not just for photography, but what the what does work in this in general is a Finder has been improved. Improved, and you can save the type of search. So you could have a search that's been saved for images searches or sound searches or video searches. So you can actually define them. It's almost like an automator function.
It's bringing smart folders to life as well, I guess.
Yeah, but this is now accessible through an actual Finder window in itself. So in that respect, yes, it is an improvement. But so I think,
are we going to drop Aperture now for this?
You're joking.
Yeah, it's made it really useful. It looks a bit bigger. There you go. That's kind of the summary, I'm guessing, though.
Yeah. But in the old days, you could always make it bigger, but it wouldn't. You just get a pixelated image. And nowadays, the way they do it, you used to do the same in iTunes as well. You got to a certain size, and that's all it would give you. If you went bigger, it just looked rubbish. And they've obviously just fixed it. Well done. It's taken you 10 years.
iPhone in Canada.ca has revealed that those fantastic people at Ion who give you all the crappy devices really cheap that actually work quite well, they've brought you out this fantastic little... Go on, sorry, mate. They make the MP3 grabber. Yeah, they make iCade. They also do a turntable that you can directly capture to your iPhone on and things like that without having to go to external speakers. They've come out with something that takes your old prints that you have, including negatives and slides, and lets you put them straight on your iPhone. It's £39, $65. So I've got to say, because I've had an Ion turntable that does straight to iPhone, and it just worked, and it was brilliant, and it was 70 quid, and it was great value for money. As their stuff's got a pretty good reputation for functioning, this is pretty special, I think, for a lot of consumers, surely.
It's I had a play with it at CES in January, and it worked as advertised. It's what I saw was a pre-production sample, and it had some fit and finish issues. But it was just really interesting. It had an area in the bottom you could slide in prints, and then a frame that you just lay your iPhone down, and it positions the lens. So it's perfectly centered over the image area. There's little LEDs inside that shine on the print to light it up. It almost looks like one of those old Kodak slide viewers that where it was like plastic. You put the slide in and it's got a screen on top. Okay. So it almost kind of looks like that, but you can also slide in prints slides and negatives in the middle of the little holder.
Yeah.
And it holds it closer to the lens, obviously, because it's smaller than a standard print. And then the LEDs inside shine through it. And they have an app that'll automatically, you know, you tell it you're you know, shooting a negative, and it filters the orange base and reverses the color. If you tell it you're doing a slide, it, you know, it adjusts appropriately. So it's pretty nice. It's something that I've kind of wished I always had. My one real gripe with it is, I guess what I'd really like is more like a tiny copy stand that I could just move the iPhone up and down and then, you know, grab like copies of different size of prints and things like that. But this is really kind of geared towards taking standard 4x6 or 3.5x5 prints.
Yeah. Alex, any thoughts?
But it works.
Yeah, my first thought was, well, why would you want one of those? But I had sort of come to it from the point of view that I copy loads of old photographs and paintings. Hello. Everyone all right?
It's taking turns. I'll be disappearing next.
Right. I hope you can still hear me. Yeah, but I've got loads of professional equipment that does a similar thing. And I was thinking, the amount of times I see on something like, I don't know, Facebook again is a good example, of people that have tried to copy an old school photo and they want to share it with everyone. And, you know, It's appalling. So there's a, I would have said there's quite a big market for a very cheap and cheerful, straight to your iPhone, so you don't have to do anything clever with it, auto upload to Facebook. And, you know, for what you get, the price doesn't seem too bad either.
I think it's great. I think the only thing that bothers me a little bit with it is, why would you put your photographs on your iPhone? Now, that's really consumer-based, because someone's got an iPhone, they want their photographs to go straight on their iPhone, and they'll carry it around, and that's it. But if you're talking about taking your old collections from the 70s, you could be talking a couple of hundred images here. And once you've got them on your iPhone, if for the average consumer, you've then got the issue of getting them off. Unless you're into double twist and you're into that kind of hack-esque way of getting stuff and files off on and off your iPhone, you're immediately locked into the iPhoto, which again is very limiting as a library to actually find the originals for a consumer and put them out. But if you gave it to your mum and said, here's an iPhone, put your photos through here, Chris, would you have said that your grandma would have managed that?
Oh,
or is
yeah.
It, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about my mother, who couldn't switch the TV on the day before yesterday. She caught the, I ran up to my mother's. I got a phone call. The TV, the box wants to scan, which is like a Humax box underneath. It wants to scan the channels, and I don't know what to do. I've been onto their technical support, and they couldn't help me. And they couldn't help you, Mum, because it's the TV that wants to scan the channels because you've hit the wrong button. All you got to do is go back to inputs. And it's like, I'm there for 35 seconds. No, I mean, it's that's good. If it's easy to use, Ion, I like Ion, I have to say. It's a crappy brand, and it's got crappy brand written all over it. But like you said, it just works, doesn't it?
I wouldn't say crappy. I'd say cheap. It's cheap.
Economy.
But that doesn't mean necessarily crappy. Yeah.
A budget brand.
Affordable.
Affordable, even better. The patronising terms just keep coming.
Mm-hmm.
Lytro has issued a version of its manual in Windows. When it's software. There we go.
Yeah.
Has anyone... I had a little go with one of these the other day at the Bash, and there is a little button on top when you press it to get your image, but it's... I didn't realise that they didn't have any software for Windows at all. I would have thought it just outputted JPEGs, but clearly not.
Mm-mm. No, they call them living images.
That's what they have to have, yeah.
But have some kind of...
Yeah, but I thought you might have been able to output a JPEG from it, but no.
Mm-mm. You have to convert to a JPEG once you've done your focusing.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which you can do with the software, but they started out with basically they have a web version, but it runs in Flash, and then they have a Mac client, and that's been the case for the last, I don't know how many months, so it's been out, 6 or 7 months.
Right, so this wasn't an inhibitor to sale then?
Because
you had the Flash version.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm really curious to know what their sales are like, just because it's such an unusual thing, and I know a lot of the early reviews were pretty critical of it. I mean, I got to use one. I think it was at CES, and I thought it was nice. But I think that I'm personally have a tendency that's more like something unusual. Let me explore it. Let me figure out how it works. Let me see what's new about it.
Mm.
And I think that a lot of people were just like, this camera's dumb and it doesn't do what I want it to do. And, the pictures are only 2 megapixel and they're not really looking at the fact that it's like, you can just shoot and then fix the focus anytime you want. You can even change the depth of field.
I had a play with it, like I said, at the Bash with Betsy's, and there was a bit of it that kind of made me think, okay, that's interesting, but I fix the focus before I take the picture. Always.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't usually want anything else. So, the long-awaited Canon EOS M mirrorless camera.
Was this long-awaited? Were people waiting for this?
Well, apparently, according to Petapixel, it was. Yeah. The EOS M mirrorless camera has been officially unveiled. Alex, had a look at the stats.
I had a look at the stats.
Were you waiting long for it or not?
Oh, I've been waiting at least 7 or 8 minutes now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very nice.
I honestly was surprised by the announcement.
Really? You didn't think it was coming at all?
No, I just don't really... I didn't really see any need for Canon to move into this market. I mean, you know, Nikon took their jab with the one series that, and from what I hear, it hasn't been that successful. People are not that thrilled with it. I don't know. I don't know. Were people waiting for this? Were people hoping I could get, you know, a mirrorless Canon system with?
I read some stories. I had to
use different lenses, and
I read some stories on it was either this or a similar concept a couple of weeks back. And what they were talking about was that this would have a detachable lens, but you wouldn't be able to put your Canon lenses straight on. You'd have to buy an EF mount, and you couldn't use your EFS lenses. You'd only have EFs, and that looks like what's happened here. So this is what was talked about a couple of weeks back. The lens that comes with it is not compatible with Canon. You just need, but you do need your EF. And it didn't say whether the autofocus was catered for within that. I'm hoping it would be, because that's just not exactly hard, is it?
It's just the N1 and J1, and it's Canon's version of it.
Yeah.
And it they did something that doesn't surprise me, which is they're using their own APS-C size CMOS sensors, and they're not using, you know, some ridiculous 1-inch sensor, because if you look at this camera, it's every bit as small as that Nikon 1 series.
I think
the camera, the body is anyway. The lenses might be a little bit bigger, obviously, because it's imaging on a much larger sensor. But this is the same kind of route that is it Samsung? Mm. I know Sony has their mirrorless system, and it uses APS-C size. I think Samsung also uses the size.
And as Alex says, also most notably, that Nikon have. So, I mean, one of the questions I've got in my mind as an SLR user from Canon, I'm sitting looking, well, why would I want this? And Alex, you've had the benefit of knowing whether you do or you don't want it, because presumably the same principles applied for the N1. You know, it was something that was smaller, it was lighter, your lenses would have fitted it. I mean, from a pro viewpoint, is there anything that would make you want to take this and go and buy it as your day out camera with a few of the other lenses that you had kicking about from your Nikons?
To be honest, no, because if I was going to carry around all my lenses, I'd probably just go with a very cheap, small Nikon body that would have taken my lenses anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to spend another $300 on something that's inferior to a D5000 range or 3000 range even. There's no point to it. I mean, the cameras aren't that big. What is the pain? Isn't the camera body, it's the lens. And if you're going to take the lens with you anyway, why worry about the camera body?
Yeah, no, I'm thinking about things like, you know, classically the 50mm lens that I shoot an awful lot with. 1.8, it gives you that versatility. You can get out with it, and it's not a huge lens to carry around. That little adapter would make it, you know, a nice little tiny body that I could get that flexible lens on might appeal for a day out. Because, I mean, that lens, I love taking that lens around. I shoot great pictures with that lens. I've got massive variability on depth of field. It's fixed to 50mm. It makes me move my feet. You know, I get a lot of good images on a day out, but I really don't want to take a 1DS Mark II for sure. And even you know, a D60 is still too big.
Well, here's what I'm thinking, and I'm just looking at it and thinking about it. I don't think this is going to appeal to any existing Canon DSLR owner. I think this might appeal to someone who is maybe on the fence about considering a DSLR, but have a pocket camera, maybe want something a little bit better. But I feel like it addresses such a small niche of consumers at this point. I'm just not sure. I mean, it looks cool. It looks well put together. You know, spec-wise, I think it's going to appeal. You know, it has a pretty wide appeal. You know, it's comparable to what this just the T4i Rebel, newest Rebel model they announced recently. I mean, image quality-wise, spec-wise, it's very similar. You know, and we've talked before about the mirrorless market is really the biggest growth sector. So maybe this is just Canon looking to put something into that area. You know, as a as someone who owns DSLRs and a bunch of Canon lenses and flashes, this does not appeal to me because I have to use an adapter for the lenses. There's going to be some focal length changes and things like that I have to deal with. You know, I mean, I could use my flash on it, but
are they going to come out with a little series of lenses that will have that kind of esque quality about them of being able to, you know, better f-stop right the way down to 2.8, 1.8, 1.4, 1.2 maybe? Or is this, you know, they've got to bring, if they've got an interchangeable lens camera, they've got to bring out a series of lenses that are going to go with it, surely, Alex?
Yeah, they've got to do it, but...
Which Nikon haven't, particularly.
Yeah, but the thing is, what I think that it's not even an issue. If you don't own a camera and you want to get, and you've got some money to get into photography, this is now a third option. You've got your point and shoot, you've got your DSLR, and this is in the middle. But I don't necessarily think anyone that's got either of the other two are going to want this as an extra option. I think this is an option on its own. So, you know, it doesn't particularly appeal to me, but no. It's because I've already got both other ends of the spectrum. It's a compromise, and I don't need to compromise.
A couple of comments in the chat room here. iBookery has said... I've lost him. Little mirrorless cams just begging for a 70 to 200 f2.8 Canon lens. Really not. That'd snap off. And surely the adapter's going to have to be quite small and light, or is it going to be big and bulky? Well, I would have said that if it's big and bulky, it's going to give you a significant change in focal length, which kind of makes it pointless then. If you're carrying a 50mm lens around, but with the adapter it suddenly becomes a 100mm lens, there's no point at all.
No.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's got to be light. But then the question will be about the autofocus.
So, I don't know if you guys can see this.
Okay.
But here's Pentax's little Q camera.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got basically a point-and-shoot size sensor. Okay?
Yep.
And it's got interchangeable lenses.
But is it standard K-fit?
What's that?
Is that the standard K-fit for Pentax?
No. Not at all. It's its own custom small Q fit. So you can see the lenses are quite small.
Got you.
Now this I find interesting, and because it's so tiny. I mean, I have this little case here, but I've got the camera, like all the lenses that they make, a charger, extra battery, some filters, everything, and it's just this little tiny case that would hold like maybe something the size of a Canon G1 the GX G series type cameras. That I think is interesting because you get a lot of versatility, but if you're going to go with something like these mirrorless cameras and you've got the same size sensor as a DSLR, your lenses are going to be a little smaller because you can take out some of that back focus distance, but they're not that much smaller than standard lenses. And I feel like at that point, why not just use a standard DSLR?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe people just like loving having that live view all the time. Don't like an eye level finder. I don't know.
Maybe. It's an interesting thought. And like I said, if I could just whack my 50, I think what I'd like to see is just something I could just whack my 50mm lens on and be done with it and go out. That'd be great. I'd probably buy that at $300. I think that'd be a good purchase. Last thing, the Fujifilm has released their EXR. This thing's a 20 optical zoom, 16 megapixel camera, 25 to 500mm equivalent on the zoom. Features Wi-Fi as well. Looks like fairly decent specs. The price is $349.95, available for August. If you've got $299 burning a hole in your pocket for a Canon, or $349 for this Fujifilm, which are you going to go for?
Fuji.
You're going to go for this?
And I'll tell you why, right? Because
he's never held one and his mind's made up.
Nah, I'll tell you why. Okay, now I look through all the specs. Now, you've got all the normal specs, right? But Fuji do certain things, and they do certain things which are really good for consumers. Okay, forget about the built-in filters and all that nonsense, not interested. But they've got a three-way auto mode with motion detection, right? Perfect for nightclub camera, and perfect for all this sort of thing, yeah?
You want a nightclub camera?
No, I'm talking about necessarily for me, but you've also got this higher resolution priority mode, okay, which uses the whole of the sensor. But alternatively, you can go for a dynamic range priority mode, which takes a couple of pictures and puts them over, which will help in dark situations, low noise situations. And also they've got a signal to noise ratio priority mode, which is basically it uses half the resolution, but he doubles up on the megapixels it uses for each pixel. So therefore you've got far better low noise in daft situations. Mm. Now, if you're starting off with 16 megapixels, what they've done with this, they're saying we're going to use that megapixelage and we're going to use every trick that we can, which isn't software-based, but every trick we can use in the sensor as well as we can to get you out of all sorts of situations. So I think if you've got one of these in the...
And we'll never know the rest of that. Chris had a look at this?
Yeah.
Is the HR, DR, and SN modes enough for you?
Well, I mean, Fuji's been using these modes on some of their cameras in the last, I don't know, year or so. I mean, I think they're definitely some compelling features. What interests me most about this camera, and I think there's an earlier, like an F700 or something like that, that I've been talking to Fuji about looking into this. But with the Wi-Fi models, they have this app you can use on your smartphone, and it just jets pictures that you take over to your smartphone, and then you can send them to, you know, you can Instagram them, you can put them on Flickr, you can email them, whatever, blah de blah. But the great thing about it is it's sort of a stopgap. We've been talking about, you know, these cameras should be wireless, always on. And this is the reason why people are so enamored with their smartphone as a camera, is because they can do all the stuff with the picture once they take it.
Yeah.
So they've got this Wi-Fi camera, and it's got some apps and stuff in it that you can use while you're on Wi-Fi. But if you're not, you know, at home on your home network, or you're not at some convenient public Wi-Fi that you can access, which, you know, sometimes it's good and sometimes it's garbage. What can you do with your pictures now? You're you know, out of the range of Wi-Fi, and I think this is it's maybe kind of a stopgap, kind of a middle ground. But instead of building in the 3G into the camera and making you have a data contract and do all that stuff, it just spits it over to your phone and lets you do whatever you do with your phone. So you have the benefit of having all the apps that you would normally have on your phone. You don't have to buy any new apps. You don't have Fuji doesn't have to include any kind of editing software. They don't have to include an Instagram client and a Flickr client, a Facebook client.
But at 16 megapixels, that's crazy big.
Sure.
It's crazy big for Instagram.
Hey, my iPhone can handle it.
Alex, do you need to finish anything off?
I don't know where I was. I'm just so fed up with Skype today.
Teresa's already called you a man about town, which may be the title of the show. Well done, Teresa. And she said you'd already convinced her she needed to buy one before you disappeared, though. So there you go.
Thank you, Teresa.
Your word is enough.
Now all I've got to do now is work on people in the same continent, and I'm well away.
Here we go. Six things, then. It's the Olympics starting today.
Hey.
And the restriction and limitations on photography equipment allowed inside the stadium has provided perplexing problems to overcome for people. What six tools, tips, or tricks would you employ to try and capture the golden moments of the games and beat the bastards? Thank you, Darren, via Twitter. Chris, any covert imaging tips?
I mean, I don't know what to tell you, really. I mean, you're talking sports photography, which has its own set of parameters that are pretty well known. I mean, you need a huge, long lens. You need a fast camera. You need maybe a monopod or a tripod with a fluid panning head. You need to know. And beyond that, you just need to be familiar with the sport you're shooting, so you know when to be ready for those decisive moments.
Dude, this is taking a long time for you to say. I got nothing.
Well, I'm just saying I don't know what you can do outside of that. I really can't offer any tips outside of what you would use for standard, you know, the standard sports photography tips.
The chat room's moved away from squeaky toy and has now gone to taser, which seems a bit extreme. I'll give you a tip. Capture the ambiance. Look for wide angle. Do it off your phone. Do it off something like that. Don't do it off something that's big and heavy, because you are going to get caught and you're not going to capture it very well anyway. So There's a certain element of what Chris is saying that's true there. I just wouldn't. I haven't got six tips. I just got one. Don't try and capture the sense of what's going on rather than individual close-up moments. Alex, anything?
Yeah, a couple of things. Why not use one of those holo clip things? You know,
big zoom job.
Yeah, just that'll do. But the thing is, don't try and zoom in on anything because you're just not going to get to. So if you want to take a picture of, I don't know, the javelin, don't try and take a picture of the guy throwing the javelin. Just take a picture of the overall, as Ewan said, take a picture of the field because that's the best you're going to get anyway. And if you're not zoomed in on anything, you're probably not going to get that much of a speed problem. Secondly, I'd say if you've got something like a 4S, why not just use video? You know, I know we're talking about, you know, stills on this, but video is going to give you, video doesn't have to be so sharp. Video doesn't have to be any of that stuff. And if you want that moment, and if you're only ever going to really look it on your iPhone or anything like that, or upload it to Flickr or whoever it goes, do a video of it and then take a still out of the video. That's more than good enough to stick on Facebook or Twitter or something.
Yeah, absolutely. I shot a bit of footage the other day with my iPhone, 1080p. Close up with a butterfly, it looked stunning. It was crystal clear and sharp. I can't fault it.
You can take a still off that as well, can't you?
Could take a still. Only if you want 1080p, though. Quick question then. Question one. And Chris is gone. Excuse me.
It's Skype. It's not us. It's Skype is behaving appallingly today.
Yeah, yeah. Hi, all. A quick question for you. What tools, software, or workflow would you use for family photos? Obviously, for professional work, you use professional tools to make your stuff look better, and it's your bread and butter. But what should I be doing to get phones off my camera, compact cameras, or things which take less of a quality and that are less need of touching? With all these disparate sources of photos, how do you manage collating, organizing, sharing, and backing up? Bear in mind that spouses, children, etc. may not be as tech savvy as you. Thanks for everything you do. Fabulous show. Cheers, Andy. Alex, start us off.
Well, if you're using iPhones and you're all using things like iPhones, you can share one cloud. That's always quite good. In my house, it tends to be, it gets thrown onto my office desk and it's like, Dad, can you sort that out? Or husband, can you sort that out? But things like iPhoto or Aperture or something, you know, I mean, I'm sure Windows does its own thing. You know, you can just throw whatever you like into it and use that as the third party place to then title everything and get them into one venue, get them into one thing. Quite often the more the merrier, and it's interesting pictures aren't necessarily the best taken pictures. In some of the nicest pictures I've got are of me when the kids were very young. They had a camera, but they were shooting me from my waist pointing up. And it's their eye view of what was going on. And that is, for family, that's the best sort of picture. So, you know, don't worry about equipment. Just worry about everyone getting a go and then find a central place to store it, even if it's just on an external hard drive and you chuck everything in one place and then put it in photo, iPhoto or Aperture afterwards.
But if you're in the Appleverse, there's no question that iPhoto does a great job for that and it's very family friendly.
Yeah,
you can't delete stuff easily from it. You can delete it from the front end, but you're not deleting it from the back end, so you're not losing your original. iPhoto is clearly good in Mac. I don't know if there's an equivalent of iPhoto in Windows. I know you've got Lightroom, but Lightroom's a hell of a leap forwards in comparison. So maybe iPhoto. And I would say just get rid. The one thing I do is I don't usually use Aperture for knowing where photos are. I just have a very good file system that tells me, I break down my commercial images into different types and then those are all subdivided. And I can find an image that I've shot maybe even sort of 6-7 years ago within a couple of seconds because I know where to look in the structure. Just get a structure that's yours and be familiar with it. And find
I have got enough. One really, really far out idea though.
Go on then.
Go to the chemist and get them printed and stick them in an album.
Oh, bugger. That's silly. That's just...
Yeah, that's ridiculous. I'm sorry I even mentioned that. I've embarrassed myself now.
Hi, guys. Long-time listener and continuing to enjoy the show and learn things. Keep up the great work. I figured that since you and Alex are in and around London, it must rain a lot, and I want some advice on umbrellas. Aha. They use them in Chicago and Florida as well. I have a Canon 7D and a Speedlight 430X2, and I want to begin experimenting with off-camera flash and an umbrella as a light modifier. I thought that this would be easy, but I find that there are 32, 45 inch and 60 inch umbrellas. I see that they mostly come in silver and white, and the white umbrellas can be used for reflectivity or shoot through. Most of my shooting will be people shots, head shots, body shots, etc. I try to plan shooting outdoors. I plan to try and shoot outdoors as well. And umbrellas seem to cost about $15 to $35, which is good, but the umbrellas or perhaps umbrellas would be recommended for... But what umbrellas or perhaps other umbrellas would you recommend for someone's first try using one with a speed light flash? And that's the difference between reflecting off silver and white umbrellas and shooting through white umbrellas, and does size matter? Tom Gifford of Rainy, Portland, Oregon. Chris starts off... There's a lot there, yeah, but...
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing, if you're going to use umbrellas outside, you're going to break a lot. And that's just because at the tiniest gust of wind and they're over. I've lost no end of them through shooting. And I've been like canopy terraced. I shot a wedding at Lord's a few years ago, and it was the big canopy at the top end above the members' pavilion, and it was a really still summer's night, and there was just this one little gust of breeze, and both of them went over, and I had two beautiful white umbrellas that I had. There you go. That's the point. I would get small if you're going to go outside because there's less chance of it catching the wind, and also if you've got a speed light, I don't see the point in having a 60-inch umbrella, because whether you're reflecting or shooting through won't make any difference because it won't spread the light fast enough. And if you're reflecting off it, I wouldn't have thought that a speed light's going to generate anywhere near enough power to use a 60-inch to its fullest degree anyway. You're probably better off just buying 32s and buy as cheap as you can get, because and treat them as disposable, no?
Well, here's what I think is actually the bracket to hold the speed light and the umbrella and adjust the angle is going to be way more expensive than the umbrella itself, and maybe even more than the lighting stand you put it on. So I wouldn't at all worry about the cost. It's really just, like you said, the size. The 430 EX is a pretty small unit. It doesn't have a lot of power, and 32 inches probably the best it's going to work with it. And again, shooting through probably is not that great. I would use a reflecting umbrella with a speed light like this for sure. And it's definitely going to modify your light. It's going to soften it up. I think I agree with you too. Using it outdoors probably isn't going to be much use unless you, if you get any kind of wind, it's just going to tip over your light stand. So that's that.
There was one thing I bought a few years ago as well, which was an inflatable diffuser that went on the front of my speed light. And that was brilliant. I mean, that cost me like $5, came from the China, and you just blew it up, and it was wonderful. And if you've got like the kids' armbands for swimming or the rings, rubber rings, if they're clear on one side and frosted on the other, that'll act as a diffuser as well. I mean, I think you're better off trying to diffuse the flash than trying to reflect or bounce it to diffuse it. Alex, any last thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I would always go for diffused outside. But also with all this equipment, the reason, I don't know about Ewan, but the reason I pay a premium for professional equipment is purely on the grounds that it's open and shut, moved, bang, drop, whacked. And, it needs to be really robust. But if it's something you're only going to use occasionally, don't spend the money. You'll be amazed the alternatives for... I mean, I can buy a flash kit for $5,000 for a three-head flash kit, or you can go and buy one for £250. Now, that £250 one, it won't be as good, but it's certainly not 10 times as bad. Yeah. And if you're only going to use it occasionally, that is all you need.
Yeah, no, I agree, absolutely. I mean, we used to do a thing called cheap thingy, didn't we, guys?
Yeah.
Which maybe we should bring that back, which was, make a diffuser out of this, buy a light fin out of that. And like I said, magic tape over the front of flashes are wonderful for diffusing. There's tons of stuff out there you can do that's cheap or free. Don't buy expensive stuff. Camera shops just rip you off. The other thing is as well, Alex is talking about the multiple use of those. My problem is any time before the manufacturing warranty is going to run out, I'll end up sitting on it. So it's It's having to deal with me, not the number of opens and closes. Last question then. Hi guys, having spoken on Twitter, I know that particularly Ewan is often challenged with creating impact in images for advertising in circumstances which are perhaps not often apparently easy to do so. Working with machinery or in commercial environments, it might be difficult to create something which is striking and makes the most of something which is otherwise boring. I'm sure that Alex is often confronted with pieces of artwork which are unattractive, and also Chris must often have to make the images for his articles in Ars Technica, which are of tech that may have a great function but doesn't look very good. Do you have any quick tips for adding impact to ordinary pictures? Martin Fellows of Manchester. Alex, starts off, sir.
It's all in the lighting. That's where it comes. If you've got something that's a little bit dull, I mean, to be honest, if I've got a dull painting, I'm supposed to make the painting look as dull as it is. I'm not there to make it look any better because the artist wanted it to be dull and he might not see it that way. But with a piece of, it's all about contrast with lighting. And if I've actually got something that's not very interesting, the main thing is to make the background as plain as possible. Because if you've got a completely plain background or something with a gradient of light going through it, anything in front of it stands out. Recently, I had to take a picture of a nail, right? It's a very artistic nail. It's really important now, apparently. I won't say too much, just in case I get in trouble.
It's holding up London.
It's only, 4 inches? It's a nail. It's no more than that.
Trust me, there's nothing wrong with 4 inches.
Anyway, what I did is I used the lighting in such a way that made the background lighting dissipate and disappear into the distance. So it went from a sort of a brownie to a grey, you know, it's just the way you light it. And I lit it at such a way that there was highlights on the nail. You know, it's a nail. There's nothing too exciting about it. But when I finished with it, and you make sure that you've got the right amount of contrast, and sometimes you have to add that, you know, afterwards with levels, but you've got the right amount of contrast, even a nail can become looking like a work of art. So it's all in the lighting. And for goodness sake, if it's boring, make sure there's no background to compete with it.
Great. Good tip. Mr. Forsman, what do you have for us, sir?
This is so interesting, and Ewan's going to hate my answer, but a lot of times I use analog and slap some filters on there. But a lot of times I'm stuck. I have a story. I've spent a lot of time working on it, and I need something to kind of illustrate it. A lot of times I have to throw together images at the very last minute. Like it's the very last thing I do when I spend the least amount of time on it. But sometimes they come out really great. And so the real trick of it is, really just like Alex said, just, you know, looking for a real interesting angle, separating your main subject from the background. So a lot of times I do this with my iPhone, which has a lot of depth of field. So what I do is I'll focus very close on something, and that gives me enough separation from like a close-up object and something in the background that the background will be out of focus, and I can play with the positioning. So sometimes those background elements add to what I'm doing, or sometimes I eliminate background elements, so I just focus on the subject. But yeah, I'm guilty as charged. I just fire up analog and put on a filter and I just click around until I feel like it has, you know, enough impact, enough, you know, unique look to it, and put it up there. And it's honestly, like, it's saved my bacon a few times, because otherwise I feel like the picture would look really plain and boring. And it's worked really well.
I agree. I think analog does a certain thing, and if you manipulate it well, it probably does give you an effect that's instantaneous that you can use very quickly, particularly for reportage, as you say. I think it's an absolute dog if you want to produce anything of decent quality. But if it's a web page, I think you're probably right. It's up to the job, no question. My thought would be, and this is where I think the game has changed entirely, because when I first started doing stuff, you made sure you captured everything, because it was on film. It meant you had more versatility, you had more opportunity afterwards for crops and that kind of stuff. The game has changed completely now because with digital, you can go out and you can just start slinging the camera around any old way, shoot off a couple of dozen photos and see which one looks best. And then you've still got crop and rotation left afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
When my niece came up here and she had visions of being a photographer, and she said, right, and I started trying to teach her f-stop and all that kind of thing. And she was like, this is boring. I said, okay, here you go. And I gave her an egg and my 450D with a 50mm lens and said, go and shoot me a fantastic picture of the egg in the garden. And she went off and came back 10 minutes later and she said, I don't know what to do. I said, well, there you go. There's the problem. Do set yourself little crappy stuff like that. As Alex said, I mean, his nut and bolt is art. My nut and bolt's bread and butter. And it's like, you know, we make nuts and bolts. Can we forgive you one? Can you make it look great? And then you've got to sit and think, well, what's the features of this? What's, you know, the peaks and the troughs of the thread, or how do we, lighting as well, get, you know, that kind of stuff through. So set yourself, get the most mundane object you can find and set yourself a target of producing 10 wow shots off it. And it really is a very good discipline for you to learn.
Yeah, I mean, this is a classic assignment from photo classes. I mean, it's one I use to teach all the time.
Mm.
And the students would have to, shoot, find one subject, just something around the dorm room or anything, some object. And then they had to shoot 30 images of it. When we shot film, I'd make them shoot a whole roll of 36 pictures. Yeah, and each one had to be different.
I couldn't afford to do it with film, though.
Well, they were taking a class. It was expected they were going to use some film up for this kind of stuff.
I never want to see another roll of film as long as I live. I hated it. I was crap in a dark room anyway, so it didn't bother me. We got a review, by the way. If you'd like to give us a review, that would be fantastic. But we've had a review come in from Fang Rock, and it's just a question I thought he'd like to clarify. Fantastically useful product. I've been listening to the British Tech Network for ages. I think of you and as a Brummy Leo Laporte. My only thought would be, I'm not sure if the hosts are professionals or not. Could they make it a bit clearer? Yes, I am. I get paid to take pictures of things for companies.
Mm-hmm.
I'll send you one if you want. Alex, would you like to clarify?
Am I a professional? I've been a professional making my living, paying for various houses and various things for 25 years.
And multiple wives.
Multiple wives and loads of families. And I also get paid to give advice to other companies on taking photographs. So I think just may make me a professional.
I think so. If you get paid, you get paid. And what about you, Mr. Forsman?
I have been paid to take pictures on a number of occasions. For myself, it's never been a primary job. I've done freelance since almost 20 years. So it just depends on the... I'm not 26, I'm 36.
I know. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the question is, are you professionals? And do you get paid or don't you get paid? Yeah, we get paid. And do you make a living from it? Yes, we make a living from it. Okay.
Yeah. I personally haven't made a living from it for a long time because I'm primarily a journalist, but I still do paid jobs from time to time.
Yeah, it's all good fun, though.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Officially, we're professionals. Some of us don't. We've had a few emails that suggest we're not, but they can go stuff themselves. We'll be back again next week with Photo at 2 o'clock as normal. We've also got Matt coming up. Mr. Green is running a bit late, though, so we're going to start at 3:45 as long as no one minds. Is that okay with everyone else?
Super fantastic.
Who cares? Right. See you in a bit. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.